Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future.
The people's flag is deepest red, it's shrouded off the mass of dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its foes we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Stanley Aronowitz. Dr. Aronowitz is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. He's director of the Center of Culture, Technology, and Work there. He's a former steelworker and union organizer and a veteran political activist and cultural critic. He's written about 15 books in all, most recently The Knowledge Factory, which was a critique. Most recently The Last Good Job in America.
2001. Knowledge Factory was the one before that.
Great. And, well, you're welcome, Stanley.
Hi.
You're also now the Green Party candidate for governor of the state of New York, which I want to get to in a second.
That's right.
But we were chatting just a second ago, and we were chatting about the fact that we used to be involved in democratic socialist politics together, and that's kind of morphed into now green politics, and I want to talk a little bit about that, because you established a name for yourself as an academic and an activist in the 60s and 70s with work on labor theory and democratic socialist theory, and over the last 10, 15 years, you've shifted over towards a green political vision. How did that shift come about, and what were the factors in that?
Well, there are probably several factors that have to be taken into account. The first one is that I perceived that the failure not only of the Soviet Union but of the social democratic experiments in Western Europe were fairly obvious, that the social democrats, who were democrats against the communists, who were essentially authoritarians, in my opinion, that was a plus. But the problem was that the best they could do was a welfare state, which was to a large extent dependent upon capitalist prosperity. And when the prosperity began to erode in the 70s and 80s, the social democrats had virtually no alternative way to preserve many of the gains that they had made after the Second World War. But beyond that, I thought that the traditional socialist left had failed to understand the depth of the ecological crisis. And in my critique of Marxism, which was written in 1980, a book called The Crisis in Historical Materialism, I began to raise this issue both for myself and for my readers about what are the implications of the ecological crisis of our time for such hallowed aims and goals as economic growth, full employment, expanding industrialization, and many other old-time both socialist and progressive ideals. I have come to the conclusion that the best part of green politics, the most valuable idea that they have advanced, is that we have an ecological crisis, and that crisis means that we have to re-examine the way we live, including the routine use of automobiles to go from one place to another. Our refusal in this country, for example, to engage in mass transit is pretty atrocious. Major improvements in mass transit, that is. We have it, but we gave it up, really, in the automobile age. But more to the point, what does our consumer society and what does our industrial society do to the ecosystems that upon which life depends? Not just human life, but life as such. And I think the Green Party, internationally, but in the United States as well, has at least opened up the question of how are we going to address these issues. And and that's why I became a Green. And I didn't become a Green member of the party until fairly recently, 2 years ago, actually. But my politics were heavily influenced by what I considered to be an ecological perspective. Now, you could say, well, maybe I should have become an eco-socialist. But the difficulty with socialism, as I said before, is that it had made a lot of, not just mistakes, but it made a major shift on one side against democracy, that was the communists, and on the other side, basically as a supplicant of this system that I think the Greens have actually begun to challenge.
Now, your next book is called Class Rules. It'll be coming out in 2003.
That's right. It may be called How Class Works. We've been having some discussions about the title, but it's either Class Rules or How Class Works. That's right.
Now, obviously, if you're writing about class, you're kind of in a post-Marxist kind of frame here that you haven't completely jettisoned the old Marxian categories altogether.
Oh, no.
And what analysis of that do you bring to green politics? I mean, obviously, there's a big problem here with who we're going to be organizing and how we're going to achieve power.
Well, the first thing I actually say is that we should be constructing a theory of class on the basis of the category of the question of power and not simply the ownership and control of the means of production. I actually say, look, if you look at power rather than exploitation, not rather than, but in addition to exploitation, but if you take power as the center of your analysis, then the small garment manufacturer, the small retail store, or restaurant, which may have 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 even employees, is not really the locus of our analysis. That is an old middle class which still exists and has existed for a very long time. And, you know, while from the point of view of the workers in those plants or those stores, it's a terribly important thing that they be unionized and they get a measure of social justice, the issue of class power has to be addressed in a different way. And so what I argue, and it's not so far from the views of C. Wright Mills, although I think I have one major difference with him, and I'll explain in a minute, is that the political directorate and the large transnational corporations on a global basis really constitute the ruling class. My conception of class is not about the working class alone. It's also about the subordinate classes. It's also about the class structure of this stage of international or global stage of capitalism. The second thing I argue is that the distinction between class and social movements, if you look at power, is a historical distinction, which means the labor movement did not make the alliances with black people and with feminists and with the disabled and other kinds of social movements that emerged not only in the 60s and 70s and 80s, of course that's their apex in some sense, but throughout the 20th century, they did not make those alliances, and as a result, those movements move towards a much more identity basis for politics. And I think the identity politics was always in some ways unfortunate, but it was necessary because the labor movement and many sections of the traditional working class in general had sort of abandoned the fight for racial justice, the fight for women's liberation, the fight, you know, for ecology. As a matter of fact, they found themselves as adversaries to the environmentalists, and I thought that was a very tragic moment in American history as well as in other countries as well. So I say that what we need to do is conceive of the class that is in opposition and insurgent and that would make the possibility of a new society. That class would include what we now consider to be not only the labor movement but the social movements, and that we have to have a much more nuanced idea. This is my third point. We must have a much more nuanced idea of who's the labor class. The labor class is not just the industrial workers and the service workers and the clerical workers. Everybody acknowledges that that's really the old working class. But there are knowledge workers, and there are people who are contingent and part-time and temporary workers, and there are people who are called consultants, in many cases without benefits, in some cases without real salaries, and their lives are very insecure, that we have to have an understanding that as knowledge has become the main productive force in the societies in which we live, the people who produce knowledge are in a particularly important space. They occupy a particularly important space in the social structure. And I'm not arguing that they're more important than industrial workers or clerical workers or anybody else. What I'm saying is that they are an integral part of what now constitutes that class which has been rendered powerless. So I have a long discussion of that question in this book. And then I say, look, I say, look, we have a fundamental overarching question, and that is the ecological question, what you just pointed to before. And I say that here is a movement that has had a history, and I repeat some of its aspects. But the question about this move, about ecology, is whether capitalism can sustain itself, or is capitalism become an impediment in the light of the ecological crisis? So the joining of the old socialist project, that is the project of addressing the issue of capitalist power, class power in the old sense, and the new sense of power, that is the power over ecology, has to analyze whether capitalism is itself able to address the ecological crisis, and I argue that it can't. And that's one of the most important basis of the unity of the old exploitation classes, the classes who argue about social, about economic justice, and the new groups who have taken a position that on issues of feminism and on issues of race and on issues of ecology and disability, that we have to have a new kind of movement. Because what the ecology movement really does is pose the systemic issue in ways that none of the other movements do. So there's a whole big chapter on that subject. And then I talk, finally, about the question of history and whether we are at the end of history, as Francis Fukuyama. And actually, many people on the left have argued that the collapse of the Soviet Union and the move right of the Chinese and other societies that once called themselves revolutionary societies, and their move to the right into the free market, so to speak, does that end history itself? And I argue no, that in fact history, they said history was a history only if they had a transformation in the ownership and control of the means of production. I say that's not a standard that is viable, nor was it ever viable. So I go back and I really do a critique of Marxism from a much more fundamental point of view.
I'm speaking with Dr. Stanley Aronowitz. He's a professor of sociology at the City University of New York, director of the Center for Study of Culture, Technology, and Work, veteran activist, author of many books, and the Green Party candidate for the governor of state of New York. Stanley, one of the tensions between socialist politics and green politics is over the attitude towards technology. And your book, The Jobless Future, was an examination of structural unemployment in the face of automation. And you've also written more recently a book, The Last Good Job in America. And I guess
that's my job, by the way.
That's your job. Yours,
my job.
Yours
it's the job of people who have control over their own time.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I argue. A good job is a job that gives you the maximum amount of control over your own time so that you can do many things and not simply a job of work for some corporation or some government or some agency or some, or a university or something like that.
Well, the old Marxist vision was that the automation of work would eventually get us all to the point where we would have that realm of freedom. We would move from the realm of necessity to the realm of freedom and be freed from necessary labor. The Greens seem to, in general, be opposed to industrialization, automation, and technology in general. Do you see that as a tension within the politics?
I think it's a tension in Green politics. Their critique of technology is that it does more harm than good, and I think there's a lot of evidence that they have that can sustain that point of view on the one hand. On the other hand, I still, and I'm speaking for myself, not for the Green Party, that I still hold that given this stage of history, this particular moment in history, that technological changes have gone so far that to oppose them as such is not a very good idea. The best thing to do would be to actually find ways of making the shorter work week possible and make guaranteed income possible. So I'm a strong, enthusiastic supporter of shorter work week and of guaranteed income, as a consequence of the contradictions of the technological developments of our time. Now, I think that is a better way to go than to oppose technology per se. However, when you talk about things like genetically modified organisms, which, I mean, we're now in the biotechnology age, at least era, and when you talk about things like like genetically modified organisms and the use of chemical pesticides in food, and when you talk about technologies that not only destroy jobs but destroy people, and when you talk about issues about who will control the technology, as is now the case in the fight of the West Coast longshoremen, who didn't oppose the technology. They opposed the fact that these would become non-union jobs, that there's a new technology basically counting cargo and cataloging cargo that the employers wanted to put as a non-union job. What you're getting in is another kind of fight, and the Greens would not have any difficulty with this. Greens have been very strongly in support of the West Coast longshore strike, or longshore slowdown, or in the longshore side against the lockout. And the reason is because they believe that unions are good for workers, and that's not in question in the American Greens. These are not tree huggers alone. These are people who care about social justice, care about racial justice, care about class justice, and it's a very different movement than has been portrayed by most people. I don't know about Connecticut, but I'm talking about New York. I'm talking about California, and the Greens are the biggest states.
Your campaign slogan and strategy seems to be right off the bat confrontational and kind of in your face, because tax and spend is your slogan. Can you tell us a little bit about the thinking about why you decided to make tax and spend your slogan?
Because the tax breaks that have been given to large corporations by state and the federal government have actually resulted in the erosion of public goods. Less money is available for education, for higher education, for health care, for mass transportation, which is a very ecological proposal, because the tax structure has, over the last 40 years, been flattened by a series of both legislative and executive initiatives. People don't realize this. I guess it will become as a shock to some of your listeners that in the Eisenhower era, which ended in 1961, beginning of 1961, the maximum rate on the highest incomes tax rate was 91%. It's now 38%. And in the state of New York and in the federal government as well, we've seen these giveaways. Bush just gave away $3.5, mostly to the top 1% or $200,000 income earners and over. And our governor, Pataki, gave $2 billion largely to the same folk. And my argument is we have to have a new tax, but that tax should not be a tax on sales or a tax on property. That tax should be a tax on incomes of over $80,800 a year, which is the maximum amount that one pays in Social Security. The cap is $80,800, and then you're home free. And I argue that 2% tax on income over $80,800 would raise in the state of New York $4 billion, and that's still not going to be enough. And I argue that we ought to have an assets tax on those corporations doing business with the New York, the Amex, and the NASDAQ stock exchanges. Now, that is more an approach than a solution alone. We need other taxes. We need other discussions of the tax structure. But in a campaign environment, my argument is that you will find both political parties ignoring the issue because they will not bite the hand that feeds them, namely the same corporations who have been getting the bounty from actions of politicians of both parties in supporting them. For example, we have a very rich man who's running in our election. His name is Thomas Golisano, and he's from Rochester. The state of New York gave his company, Paycheck it's called, $600,000 subsidy. What's that about? When there's overcrowded classrooms, when there's a threat of tuition increases in higher education and so on. So I'm saying let's tax fairly and spend wisely. And the other part of that slogan is that I want to begin to get people away from the idea that if anybody talks about taxes, that's the kiss of death. And it's not true. It should not be the kiss of death, because we need them, and we've been losing revenues. And, of course, now in a time of recession, we are especially losing revenues. So that's part of my thinking.
The traditional left was a little slow to get on the bandwagon with drug decriminalization.
I think of course, that's my policy.
And that is your policy, and I'm glad to see it. It's of course, the Greens have been with that for many years now. Is that getting some traction? I know that now in Nevada there's a referendum out there to decriminalize marijuana entirely.
At this moment, the Democratic candidates, well, there's only one now, he's Carl McCall, has called for reform of the drug laws that provide mandatory sentencing for those who are caught with possession of marijuana and other drugs. The Republican governor has stood fast in his support of the Rockefeller drug laws, But the Democrat is not for decriminalization. In this state, we're spending $2.5 billion a year on prison. The only program that the governor has for upstate economic development. And if we decriminalize drugs, we would save a large portion of that $2.5 billion, and we could put it into education, single payer health plan, and a number of other programs that are sorely needed.
Now, I work at a college and you work at a university, and you've written now two books about the universities.
One about the universities. Which is the other one?
Your book with a book about education in the 1980s.
Oh, I've written three books on education. One is called Education Under Siege. The other is called Postmodern Education. And this third one is called The Knowledge Factory.
The Knowledge Factory.
That's right. Three books.
Could you just summarize for us, what are some of the you're concerned about corporatization most recently of the university. What are some of the trends that bother you?
Well, the vocationalization of the degree. We have a number of small private liberal arts colleges that try to hold on to the tradition of the human sciences, and you know, that means philosophy, literature, history, languages, and so on. And some of them do a better job, and some of them don't do such a good job, but basically they are almost alone. And any of the public universities, without many exceptions, I would think, what's happened to the university is that it's become obsessed with forging partnerships with private industry, with the whole job object of a college education. I don't think the purposes of a college education is to get somebody a job. Purpose of a college education is to have somebody become an educated person, and also to become a better citizen, to be able to make the decisions that affect their own lives. And that is completely, if not completely, almost completely vanished from the goals of most universities and colleges.
How would you change? I mean, I as a college administrator, I'm often engaged in various kinds of debates about how we might admit different kinds of students or what kinds of programs we might have. What would you imagine the policy ramifications of your critique being?
Well, the policy ramification, in my view, would be to set up a situation where the first 2 years of the curriculum would exclude any vocational subjects at all. I don't know whether this can be done. I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't think that a policy proposal like that is easily accepted, but I think we ought to be fighting for as much time before this vocational training aspect of college goes in, even the majors, you know, the major that you might have in history, for that matter, in any other subject, sociology especially, where you learn statistics and all of the pseudoscientific things that sociologists learn. That I would say that we should give, you know, you remember the Beatles song, Give Peace a Chance, right? That we ought to give learning a chance. We ought to give critical inquiry a chance. We ought to give literature, art, and music, and history, and philosophy a chance, so that even if the student goes on to do something, you know, scientific or technological or something else, they know somewhere in their mind they've had exposure to a different view of the world, a view of the world which I think would be provided by a critical program in the human sciences.
Stanley, the labor movement and the Democratic left inside the Democratic Party, such as it is pretty pissed off with the Green Party after the last election. They blamed the election failure of Al Gore on Ralph Nader.
Well, there are three things I would say. The first thing is that Gore won the election, the popular vote, and we are saddled in our political system with an electoral college, which is one of the more undemocratic from the point of view of equal opportunity, equal access to decision making. It's one of the most undemocratic political provisions of our system. The second, however, is rather important. Al Gore ran a campaign that could not consistently take Nader's issues and run with them, because he was more concerned with his right than he was with his left. Had he co-opted Nader's issues, he might have done a whole lot better. As it was, he didn't run a very good campaign. And having said all that, I would say that the Democratic Party has an obligation, given what happened, to re-examine its politics. The obligation is on the Democrats to decide whether they're a party of the left or whether they're a party of the center. If they're a party of the center, why shouldn't we have a multiple party system in which, you know, a left party keeps on goading them and everybody else in the society? Europe has that. And that's my answer.
Stanley, I really want to thank you for joining us, and keep up the good intellectual work, and good luck with the election.
Thanks very much.
Democracy is coming to the USA.
Last year, the Bush administration and pro-life Republicans in Congress killed legislation to ban reproductive cloning to make babies, by insisting that the bills also ban cloning for research purposes. Now the Bush administration and the Vatican are blocking a resolution at the United Nations to ban reproductive cloning. Again, they oppose research use of embryonic tissue. While I don't agree with their reasons for opposing the cloning bans, I welcome the fact that they are a roadblock in this silly stampede. To be sure, reproductive cloning is currently not safe, and any group or doctor offering it to desperate parents should be barred from doing so. But once research has perfected reproductive cloning, there are no sound reasons to deny its use by would-be parents. The timing and kind of children we bear are the most personal and life-changing decisions we can make, which is why our reproductive freedoms are so important. The right to use cloning, once safe, should be another reproductive choice to be protected, along with contraception and abortion. Not long ago, bad science fiction movies and religious dogmas were arrayed against test tube babies. Today, in vitro fertilization is an accepted, mundane, widely used tool. Just as with in vitro fertilization, opponents of reproductive cloning deploy a dozen tenuous hypothetical scenarios in which society or the clones would be harmed by cloning. But none of these makeshift reasons are weighty enough to deny people the right to control their own reproduction. Francis Fukuyama of the President's Council on Bioethics warns that fathers will lust after daughters cloned from their mothers, since they will resemble the mother as a young girl. Yet this is really an argument for adoption, since many girls resemble their mothers. Opponents worry about a brave new world or designer babies and the supposed slippery slope to totalitarianism. But the problem with reproduction in the novel Brave New World was precisely that control over baby-making had been taken away from parents and given to the state. There is no slippery slope from parents freely choosing to use cloning to totalitarianism, and dictators don't need to clone armies when they can build them more cheaply and quickly the old way. Opponents also fret that clones will face inordinate expectations from their parents. But if clones are harmed by their parents' expectations, especially the expectation that kids have the same tastes, values, and abilities as their parents, then very few people should have children at all. Cloning will only be available to the wealthy for 20 or 30 years, and there are many pressing health needs that could use those resources. But that is also true of fertility treatments in general. We can only achieve equitable access to health care through the creation of a national health insurance system, not by banning elective services. Finally, some argue that people will be harmed by not being biologically unique. Of course, no one's DNA should be used without their permission. But where does the harm come from in having a twin? Most twins appear to value their closeness. As annoyed as we can be by our similarities to our parents, they are also important to the parent-child bond. Clones will simply be delayed twins and beloved children, with all the rights and burdens of any child. The right to have a clone child, like the right to wear a red hat, is not an important right in the scheme of things. But if we take away this right, because of irrational fears, we will have lost a small measure of our freedom for no gain. Until the global hysteria about cloning settles, here is one small cheer for the Bush administration's inadvertent obstruction of efforts to ban it altogether. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.